Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with my Science Hour for September 9th, 2021, in the ongoing series of my regular show dealing with, at this show I'll be talking about Atlantis relative to the highways to the stars, or electric rivers to the stars, electric highways to the stars. And so I'll give a little bit of background here. When I gave the talk on this in Laughlin, Nevada at the International UFO Congress, I believe it was 2003, it was somewhat disconcerting because it was the same day that there was a space shuttle crash over Texas, and I happened to be driving through West Texas at exactly that time as pieces of the space shuttle were raining down across the countryside. But anyway, and here I'm on my way to a talk where I'm talking about not using space shuttle type of technology, but a much different, much more advanced technology. But anyway, the whole concept of Atlantis, and by the way, I was the talk was also based on my book Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, which I was doing a signing there, a book signing at the convention. Part of the convention was the given talks, and there were probably in attendance there certainly well over 1,000 people, probably more like 1,200, 1,500, and that was in the audience. That was in the listening group out in the audience, and there was a contingency there of military scientists who were there specifically to listen to my talk. And the whole idea was to present this idea. Well, of course, those people had heard or were aware of my work a lot longer, much earlier than this 2003 conference, because I was presenting this material, similar material, not electric highways to the stars, talking about the current so much, but the propulsion systems in the early 1980s. So anyway, this kind of gives you the setting for this talk at the International UFO Congress, Electric Highways to the Stars, and the book Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. And in that book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, is a reprint of an article that was printed in the IEEE, which is the standard for engineering, and it was published in that magazine. And that was also a result of a talk that I gave at the 19th International Propulsion Conference. That particular paper that's put into the Atlantis to Tesla book, and to put that a little bit into perspective, that was my second book, real book. When I first came out with my public books, the Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes book was listed. It was a bestseller. And that went all over the place. That sold a lot of copies. But I don't go for this New York Times bestseller list, all that stuff. Nah, don't bother me with that, please. I don't, you know. And that's for I don't know. It's not for me. Let's just put it that way. It's for some people, not for me. But the first book was Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, which was a massive big seller, because I was a well-known scientist for many decades in the scientific community, going to American Geophysical Union meetings. My main topic was dealing with solar physics and then the electrical nature of the sun and relative to the different things that were being discovered about the sun. So that was my more private life that most people never got to see, or my invited talk at Los Alamos National Laboratory, things like that, which another talk I gave at Space America, which was a trade show, kind of like the Paris Air Show that was held in San Diego, and I was an invited speaker there to give a talk on this same topic, electric highways to the stars, but more specifically dealing with the propulsion systems. Electric Highways to the Stars deals with the electrical currents, which you ride on with the electromagnetic propulsion systems. Okay, So where does Atlantis fit into all of this? And I apologize, last week I said I was going to get into Atlantis, and I never got into it. A couple of weeks ago I talked about specific impulse, the physics of comparing rocket engines and propulsion systems for outer space. But, okay, so where does Atlantis fit into all of this? And then the first question people have is, well, was Atlantis really a real place? And the answer is, of course it was a real place. It was very much a real place. Very advanced civilization. And the information that we have comes from multiple sources. But from that information, you can glean a lot of results. In fact, there's indications that it's mentioned in the Colburn. There's references to Atlantis. And some very good work by Yvonne Whiteman. She's from England and has done some amazing work relative to the Colburn, bringing out some of the things that she brings out of that text is really absolutely amazing. But it has references to Atlantis and this amazing civilization. And that's before the big catastrophe. But the way I see it, Atlantis was not part of the Venus event catastrophe. The way I see it, Atlantis was a major city-state and basically at the time controlled the world, and that was before the pole shift. They were able to navigate through what is now the North Pole, which was a big navigational area, and the entire world ocean was called the Atlantic Ocean at that time, or the Ocean of the Atlanteans. That's where it comes from. And the famous Pillars of Hercules, a lot of people think, well, that's the Rock of Gibraltar, and that's totally false. Because there's one pillar, if you want to call it a pillar, and that's the Gibraltar, the big rock out there in the middle of the Strait of Gibraltar. But there's not two of them, and they definitely refer to a few pillars, to two, the Pillars of Hercules, plural, that was the entrance into Atlantis. And it turns out that the Pillars of Hercules were the volcanoes of Krakatoa and the sister volcano, which ain't there no more because it blew up. But anyway, the smoke trails coming off of these volcanoes went up into the stratosphere. And then, of course, there was lighting of these, both the electrical part of the discharges that caused by the discharge of the vertical electric field, and then also just from the volcano caldera itself, the magma, spilling out and causing light. So you could see these pillars from hundreds of miles away. So the ancient mariners would come around and just get into the general area, and those pillars would be very visible, and that's how they got into, off of Java and Sumatra. And so that passageway led you into the marsh area that surrounded Atlantis and into the five-ringed city, which was the capital, at the very center with the pillar of the statue, the giant statue of Poseidon, or Neptune is another name, the guy with the big undersea pitchfork. It was stated that any enemies that would come in there, they had lasers that were powered by electricity, and they would burn the ships out of the water before they ever got there, so it was impossible to attack Atlantis. And the mariners talked about this, that the marsh area leading into Atlantis was very dense. You could not, there were channels that were cut, so you had to come in by very specific channels. So when Atlantis went under, it went under in a single day. And so what I believe happened is it was a slewing event. It's called slewing. And you see this around the Hawaiian Islands is a very good example, where big sections of the islands have slewed off into the ocean hundreds of miles out, and you find these deposits of the island that are just like a toboggan. They just slid away and into the ocean. But Atlantis did that. Atlantis did that in a single day. It just went boom. It was gone. So this was not related to a celestial event. It was simply nature's progress. And of course, these people didn't know it. They built their continent city empire on top of faulty ground. You just might say that. So Atlantis, though, was a five-ringed city. And that was for protection also, that if anybody tried to invade, they had to cross over the first wall, then the second one, then the third one, and before getting to the capital of the empire, which was in the very center, up on a hill. Okay, well, this is all well and good, but the other thing that there was in Atlantis, I talked about this in my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. And the reason the title for that book, by the way, is that Atlantis used atmospheric electricity. They were in a location, and very specific, was in the South China Sea. And as you entered through the Strait of Sunda, through between Java, Sumatra, and you come into the South China Sea, today even the shipping lanes are very much clogged up because of this remaining bogs of this growth, this heavy growth, like grass. It's like big weeds that float around and get caught in the propellers of the ships. And so it's a hindrance to shipping even today. Thousands of years as this bog material will float up and just float on the water. And that's because there's decaying material down in the ocean. And as the gas is generated, it'll float up and just float along the water. That's one issue. The other thing was that they had sea batteries, and that's something I mentioned in my talk. If you see the, by the way, my talk is recorded and it's visible today. It's on a 2-CD disc set that I sell on my webpage. And one of the discs has the replay. It has me, the video of me giving that speech at the UFO Congress. But the thing that they had also were seawater batteries. And the seawater battery is a bimetallic strip. There's various solutions that you can do this. And what happens is because the differential surface voltage of the surface potential of the different types of metal, you can create a circuit using just seawater and two different types of metal. So big, almost like cement vats were seen where the tide would come in, fill them up. They would use the electricity with the seawater was in the vats, and then that water would drain out. In the as the tide dropped, those would drain out, and so the batteries were not viable anymore until the next high tide. And that they're like tide pools, but batteries and the big cables going down into the water up to the center part of the city were there. And why did they need those? They needed those because that was what they used to power up the Tesla tower, and that's what Tesla was doing. And very oddly enough, he understood the vertical electric field. And I've always said, I talk about this in the Atlantis to Tesla book, that Tesla had access to the ancient texts that were housed at the in Kosovo, where he grew up. His dad was curator of the Vatican Library in Kosovo. And so my belief is that he had access to these ancient drawings, and he understood that it was related to atmospheric electricity, and therefore got his some of his plans, etc., for the Wardenclyffe Tower and his Colorado Spring experiments. Now that is, I will admit, speculation, because Tesla was a smart enough guy that he could have come up with this all on his own. But the thing that's rather strange is that he built the Wardenclyffe Tower from the first time out. And this would be the equivalent of building a 747 jet airliner by the Wright brothers. It's just too many details there that one would have to know, and one would have to know these by building first a smaller one, then a next a bigger size, then a bigger size. And he knew the operating frequency. He understood the atmospheric, the resonance frequency of the atmosphere and of the ground. And the idea was to capture the atmospheric electricity and put it into the ground and transmit it that way. And, of course, there's a lot of modern misnomers about Tesla and the Wardenclyffe Tower. And what they're saying was, oh, he was going to use that to transmit power through the air, which is ridiculous. He was gathering electricity from the air, but they're trying terribly to cover that up with a phony story. But, of course, the phony story does not hold water, because where was Tesla going to get the energy to transmit with his big Wardenclyffe Tower? Well, he had already sold all his technology to Westinghouse, and he was not allowed to use it anymore. He could not use it commercially. So where was he going to get the power to transmit? And, of course, Westinghouse, by building infrastructure, wires and cables, in delivering this electricity out to businesses and homes, intended to make a lot of money. And that so they were certainly not going to give Tesla rights to get free electricity from them to run out on his free distribution system. And so, like I say, it simply doesn't make any sense at all. But my point being that the title of the book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, was relative to my discovery that the atmospheric electricity that was used by Atlantis and was used by Tesla were the same. So Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, and the Colburn discusses the catastrophe and the comets and verifying the plasma discharge comet model and the, like I say, the ancient catastrophes. I also have a 2-CD set, just to let you know if you've forgotten. Some of you may already have this. It's called Planet X and Ancient Celestial Disasters. I'm sorry, it's called The Physics of Planet X and Ancient Celestial Disasters. So it's 18 hours of lectures. Very important to understand the history of all of this. But I digress. Okay, so the point here is that Atlantis was utilizing the vertical electric field, and the big statue of Poseidon in the middle of the city was a Tesla tower. And the way the Tesla tower works is it has a Schmidt trigger and it has a tuned circuit. It's basically a tuned circuit at the resonant frequency of the atmosphere. And as you turn it on and off, the Schmidt trigger, that is, it then goes through a Tesla coil, which takes a normal voltage, AC voltage, with a spike going from positive to negative, etc. And that's what the Schmidt trigger creates. And then at a given frequency, which is about 40 hertz. And then through the Tesla coil, which is a transformer, basically, a very high-wind transformer. So now you get an extremely high voltage and extremely fast rise time on that voltage. And what this does is the big bell on top of the Tesla tower, the Wardenclyffe Tower, what it does is it resonates at this frequency, voltage, very high voltage, and what happens above it is the induced dipoles in the atmosphere, because it's a dielectric, the induced dipoles are flipping back and forth in unison. And so what ends up happening is you drill an electric hole through the atmosphere. And remember, this is all what I discovered way back in my early studies. And it was finally, people were telling me, hey, you got to put this out in a book. You have to write this down. And so that's where the Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book came from. People encouraging me to write this down and create a book for the public. But back to Atlantis, they were using the vertical electric field. But what does that have to do with electric highways to the stars? Well, it has everything to do, because they understood about space travel and electromagnetism, how to operate propulsion systems in outer space using simply magnets. Or more correctly, plasma magnetic fields. These are free magnetic fields. These are not bar magnets, so to speak. Okay, so anyway, just a quick mention of what happens in a discharge. The discharge tends to follow the path of least resistance. So the statue of Poseidon is a collecting point. And so basically it collects the electrical current, and the electrical current then can be, because you're basically drilling an electrical hole using the Tesla Tower technique of resonating the atmosphere at its resonant frequency, what happens is the electric current concentrates. So that means that the magnetic field that's generated from this electrical current is also concentrated around the discharge. And that's your river to the low Earth orbit, basically. And there's a few aspects to this, but just in a side note, that region of the world today is still very active electrically. It's one of the most active electric areas on planet Earth, and that's where Atlantis was. Last week I talked about inertial engines, specific impulse, and it might have been over the last couple of weeks I've been talking about these topics, and the passive types of electromagnetic propulsion systems, and then there's an active type of non-inertial propulsion system. There's a passive type of non-inertial propulsion systems, and that means both cases, you're not throwing anything out of the rocket engine to make you go in the other direction. It's not a Newtonian impulse type of an engine. It's not a momentum transfer type of engine in the sense that you're moving matter to make the spaceship go in the other direction. In other words, a rocket engine. That's what everybody's familiar with. And then I use the example of the swimmer. The swimmer is expending energy, is pushing against a medium, which is water, and it makes him go forward. In the case of the electromagnetic propulsion system, you're pushing against a magnetic field, which is a plasma magnetic field, so it's much like the water in that respect, in that it is free floating. The water is in a lake or an ocean or something like that, but the water is free to move. As you swim, you're affecting the water, and the water is trying to resist your ability to swim. So it's a fluid. It's not nailed down. It's not like, let's take another example. Say you're walking. You're walking down the sidewalk. Your shoes have friction, and they're not slipping. The whole idea of a shoe is that it does not slip. If your shoes are slipping, then it's not easy to walk, like on ice or something like that. So the idea is that your shoes create friction and you move forward, but your shoes are solidly in contact with a physical surface, and you're moving forward. So that's walking is a process by putting energy into it, but you're not, once again, walking is not an inertial propulsion system. You're not throwing something back out the back end to make you go forward. There's a funny example that I use of people that don't really understand how an automobile works. And so and I've actually heard people say this. So this is not a joke. This is real life experience hearing people say this. And you say, well, what makes a car go down the road? And somebody would say, well, it's the exhaust coming out the exhaust tube. The exhaust goes in one direction, and like a jet engine, makes the car go in the other direction. And it's like, wow, this is really ridiculous, you know. But if you believed that and you went up and you measured the pressure and the mass exchange coming out the exhaust pipe, you would soon realize that there's not enough force, there's not enough impulse coming out the tailpipe to make that 2,000 pound car go down the road. And so you'd say to yourself, well, something else is going on. Maybe under that hood there, there's something that's making this car go down the road. And so you'd lift up the hood, and there's this big V8 engine or little four-cylinder engine, whatever it is, and that's the power source. And, of course, it goes to the transmission, which goes drives power to the wheels, and that's what makes the car go down the road. But with swimming, or say a boat's another example where you have a propeller on the boat, and what's the propeller doing? It's putting energy into the system. The propeller goes around. It has a blade that cuts into the water and throws the water back. So it's not an inertial propulsion system in the fact that the boat itself is not throwing something out the back end of the boat. It's pushing against a medium, which is a whole different animal. That's my point. Or swimming is the same issue, that you are putting effort, you're putting energy into the system. You have a medium, which is fluid, which is water, and you're pushing against it to go forward. And the same is true of magnetic fields. It's a fluid in a sense. It is not nailed down like to the floor. It's when you push against it, it's going to react. That's the basis also for the electromagnetic propulsion systems, that you have a plasma magnetic field in outer space. It's the result of electric currents moving in outer space. And that magnetic field, then, you can push against, if you know how to do this, if you understand how magnetic fields work. And so that's the principle of electric highways to the stars. So there's two parts to it. One is, first of all, understanding that there are electric rivers to the stars and electric currents. And the other one is dealing with my invention of the electric propulsion systems, the electromagnetic propulsion systems, that then would be used to drive you into outer space. And one of the questions has been, well, what happens? Does each star that you want to go to have its own electric circuit? And the answer is yes, they all do. They all do. So if you understand how these things work, So let me spend a little bit of time here talking about the electric fields and how they form. And this is all in my books. It starts out in the Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes book, and in the Atlantis to Tesla book, and in the, by the way, there is another book in there. I call it a pamphlet. It's the 60-page Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet. It's a supplement to Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes. But then comes the weather book, the Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun-Earth Weather. And by the way, when I create these books, etc., I plan them to be used 100 years from now. They're not just like a lot of books, they're written for like some topic of the day, and they're a flash in the pan, and they're going to come and go, and they're only relevant for a certain period of time. My books are written with the full intention that in 100 years people will be reading these as primers to understanding how space works, outer space and Earth's electric fields and Earth weather, etc. And so the next book in the series was Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun-Earth Weather, which translated means simply the weather book. And it discusses the electrical conditions that arrive from our sun that drive our weather systems. Okay, so if we look in the solar system, every planet is discharging the solar capacitor, and therefore they each have their own electric fields, and electric fields locally that then discharge, that causes primarily an electron current, and that then generates magnetic fields. So there again, you have the same situation. It's created by the sun, this big fusion engine in the center of our solar system, but it has an excess current of protons in the solar wind, which cannot continue forever because you would build up infinite amount of charge, and that's not going to happen. It would be a self-defeating process. And so what happens is there is a return current sheet to complete the circuit. And that happens where Earth is in the month of August, typically, more or less. This year it was on August 11th, and very true to form, we had advanced weather systems at the time. Also, we had the Jupiter winds because we were coupling with the electrical discharge of Jupiter at the time, which I think was actually the 11th of August. But anyway, the point is that, and that's a very good example where two planets align like Jupiter and Earth, then you get that enhanced electrical discharge, and the discharge goes along the planets. And so it's not, it concentrates the current. And this is something, I'll repeat it. Imagine that you're, in fact, a listener called in on John Moore's show yesterday when I was guest. And by the way, speaking of being guest, maybe you saw this and heard this, maybe you did not. I was the first two-hour guest on Coast to Coast AM last Monday night, Labor Day night. I was the first two-hour guest and talking about, in fact, or electric highways to the stars, electric rivers to the stars, and also water filtration and an update on Planet X. But back to the topic I was saying before I had this segue off talking about Coast to Coast, that a caller, a woman called in to John Moore's show and asked about trying to understand the electric rivers to the high, or I can't even say my own title, that's crazy. Electric rivers to the stars, or electric highways to the stars. I'll get it right one of these days. But anyway, there's a very interesting nuance. It's a nuance of physics. It's one of these strange things, and I'll explain how it happens in physics. But I use the example of the sailing ships with square rigs, and I've talked about this before. I'll just repeat it because sometimes repeating emphasizes or makes it a bit clearer in your brain if you hear it a couple times. It's a technique in teaching. But anyway, imagine you're in one of the old square sailing rigs, you know, the kind that Columbus used, or the big square rig sailing ships that came from Spain to the New World and returned with all of the booty. But anyway, imagine you're sailing across, you're in the trade winds, you're not good at going up against the wind. Those ships could not go into the wind at all. They just had very poor capability, but they could go with the wind, and it was just like put up a lot of sail and ride the waves with the wind. So at any rate, imagine you're on a sailing ship like this, and all the wind concentrates on your sail, on your sail. And this is, say, a strange property of winds, that once you put a boat out there, all the winds concentrate on that boat. But that does not happen, of course, if you're a sailor. But in the electric highways to the stars, it does happen. The electrical currents concentrate on the object there that is moving in the electric currents. And so that's a phenomenal way, because the electric current sheets in outer space, especially the intergalactic ones, the ones that run between stars, are very broad, very big and wide, and the current density is very low. But now you have the property that once you put an object there, it's going to concentrate the electric currents onto that object. And this is the same. It's the same thing that happens with the planets that are discharging the solar capacitor. That's what comets are. That's what makes comets work. And it's a magnetic effect, and here's what happens. As you have, first of all, electrons or charged particles, protons, ions, etc., when they're in a magnetic field, there's an electromagnetic force that's created on that charged particle. If you have a streamer of similar charged particles, like a group of electrons that are part of a discharge, they pull together, and the self-induced magnetic field pulls them together, and it's a textbook thing that I learned in college in my physics courses. It's called the pinch effect, and it's very interesting because it comes into play in nuclear reactions. Go there right now. That's another whole issue, dealing with fusion reactions in the surface of the sun. I talk about that in my books. But imagine you're on a sailing ship and all the winds concentrate on your sail. Well, that'd be a big benefit because you'd have all of this extra force on your sails because of this strange effect, this physical effect of winds, but winds don't do that. Electric winds do that. And that's what's, you know, and this again, imagine here I'm at Cornell University, 1979, 1980 time frame. I'm understanding the electrical nature of where these electric currents are coming from, and that comets are not dirty snowballs, and that they're a discharge of the solar capacitor, and that the galaxies, in fact, my very first peer-reviewed published paper was on galactic formation and the issue dealing with the symmetry in galaxies and galactic arms, etc. But but I realized that there are electric currents in the galactic sphere, so to speak. The nucleus of the galaxy is doing the same thing a star is. It's pumping out an excess current of protons. And so there is a return current sheet. But in the galaxy, the return current sheet has a very natural path to come down, and that is the galactic arms. I also talk about this in my DVD number 4. Or is it number three? Number three. It's the one of the hard DVDs on my sales page. But anyway, what happens then is these current sheets are flowing down the galactic arms. Okay, so very interesting. Now, if you put one of my electric propulsion systems in this arm and you get the concentration of electric currents, now you have a system to move between the stars. And so one of the questions was, this woman raised, very good question. If you want to go to the star over here, is there a different river? Is there a different segue that you would take to go to another star over there? And how does that work? And the answer is yes, that in general, each one of these stars has an electric current. So you would work to get hook into the current sheet that branches off to this particular star. Then when you come into the solar system, now this is really, really, really interesting. When you come into the solar system, what do you want to do? You would want to hook into the current sheet of either the biggest planet like Jupiter, or you would want to hook into the current sheet of a comet. A big comet would be best, like Hale-Bopp. So now you may understand why when Hale-Bopp was first discovered, and I know this because I happen to be kind of an insider, not an employee, but a person who knew people at Goddard, at the High Energy Group at Los Alamos, and other related groups. And when Hale-Bopp was publicly discovered, they were getting signals from intelligent life from the vicinity of Hale-Bopp. And so anyway, what it appears is that there were intelligent signals. That's all I'm going to tell you. I'm not going to say there were aliens or anything else. All I'm going to tell you is that there was this, and it may have been some natural phenomena that were putting out these signals also. You could give it that aspect of possibility. But that would make sense that a civilization or a group of people coming into the solar system with an electromagnetic propulsion system coming from another star would want to break on the electric current sheet of Hale-Bopp because that would give them a tremendous amount of braking power. And then they could branch off from there and go to another place in the solar system. So at any rate, these are all things that imagine me, I'm sitting here at Cornell University, understanding these things, and everybody around me, all the top NASA scientists all around me are still thinking that gravitational fields and there are no magnetic fields and there are no electric currents. They don't have a clue. And they don't even want to know because they're not allowed to think that way because of the animosity towards Velikovsky, who said, hey, the ancients saw electrical phenomena, lightning-type phenomena between the planets back in the old Venus days when Venus was a comet. And that's what Velikovsky, and all Velikovsky was doing was referring to ancient documents, which stated this. He wasn't threatening astronomy or talking about theories of comets. He was talking about the history books that were written in ancient times. What he was actually trying to do was set a deadline date or a date when some major event happened on Earth where you could coordinate the calendars of, say, China and India, which were totally separate, distinct areas, not in communication, China and the Mideast, or China and, say, ancient Europe, where there were texts, there were legends and things like that, or the American Southwest, where the Indians talked about the Phoenix Rising, which was obviously a comet. Okay, so anyway, back to the idea that Velikovsky was talking about this. And, of course, when I was at Cornell, I didn't know about Velikovsky. I had no idea. I had been out of the country for 10 years. I had not been in the U.S. I didn't know about the Velikovsky controversy. I didn't know that Carl Sagan, who was the David Duncan Chair of Astronomy at Cornell, was the person that basically destroyed Velikovsky. And so I come rolling in a few years later, 1976 was when Velikovsky died. It was 74 when they held the American Association for the Advancement of Science meeting, where they got everybody, Stephen Gould and Carl Sagan and all the boys together to destroy Velikovsky. And so I come enrolling in a few years later, right into the middle of the bees hive in Cornell, where Carl Sagan lived, and Carl Sagan got the Cosmos series. When I was there, he was making the Cosmos series out in L.A. He was becoming a movie star. But that was his payoff for getting rid of Velikovsky. But Velikovsky was not a scientist. He didn't pretend to be one. He was talking about calendars and ancient texts. But they saw electrical discharge activity. And when Venus came by Mars, it connected electrically. And it looked like a snake coming out. And there are visuals of this. There are rock paintings of this. It's like a snake coming out of the head of the comet attaching to Mars. And then it looked like, because of the auroras around the atmosphere of Mars, which was being sucked off in the oceans, because Mars had been a blue planet, an ocean, a water planet, just like Earth. But it looked like the snake coming off the comet had its mouth around the planet. And that's because of the auroras that were going on in the upper atmosphere of Mars when all of this was taking place. And so, at any rate, that's just a little bit of an aside note, some historical, very interesting historical records regarding this whole issue. But now I'm going to jump back to Atlantis, because I promised you I would talk about Atlantis. Now, the whole issue is that this is something I believe, that there were spacefaring nations that were very advanced, and they got autonomous spacecraft off into outer space. And that's right now where we're almost heading. In fact, my own personal space program is doing just that, is to build autonomous space stations that can go off into space and not come back. And they're completely self-sufficient, and they could exist for thousands of years out there with hundreds of thousands of people on them. And this may sound like a very grand plan, but it's really doable. It's really a doable project. And there again, you have the ability to move these giant spacecraft with electric propulsion systems, not with rockets, but with electric propulsion systems. Okay, so at any rate, and the reason I believe that is not because I have evidence of it, it's because that would mean that humans, not little gray aliens or anything like that, but literally humans could come back to this planet on a big spaceship like that and have to take a look at what we're doing today, what happened to the human race. But that's a way to save the human gene pool for posterity. And if we don't do that, we could be lost with a great earth disaster. But anyway, the reason I say that I believe that is not, it's not a scientific belief. It's more like a philosophical belief that certainly could have happened, and that there are humans out there in autonomous spacecraft, big ones that have hundreds of thousands, potentially millions of people on them, that have been existing on a space platform for a long time and potentially could come back to planet Earth at some point in time. Anyway, it's a philosophical belief, and it's kind of one of those fantasies that may be true, it may not be true, but it's just something that I like to talk about. Back to Atlantis. I believe that the Atlanteans were advanced. I believe that they had traveled between Earth and Mars because of where would you go? If you have the ability to go into outer space, what are we doing? The first place, the first targeted place is Mars. The moon is not that popular a place to go to. It's close by, it's kind of handy, but Mars is the place that everybody seems to want to go. And I also believe that I have serious evidence that confirms that there are archaeological ruins on Mars. And these little rover things that are roving around up there and sending pictures back is all a dog and pony show. That's just to divert the public to make you think that that's some kind of advanced science. And NASA's been getting away with this for darn near 20 years. Don't get me going on that. But the real research on Mars you're not seeing, as with this real research at the South Pole, Antarctica, where they're discovering archaeological ruins and mastodons and ancient people that are buried, flash frozen into the tundra down there, just like the mastodons and the woolly mammoths that are sold frozen into the tundra up in Siberia. Yeah, those are real things, and Velikovsky was one of the first ones to point that out in an organized manner, talking about the Venus event. And, of course, Velikovsky concentrated on the Venus event, but there were more in history. There were more events where Earth took it on the chin, had a major catastrophe because of an object coming by, which was a major league comet. Okay, so anyway, my personal feeling is that Atlantis was just one of those continents. They built it in the wrong place. The idea that it was on a big bog matches with the concept that the island of Atlantis, the small mini continent of Atlantis, just slid off into the ocean one day and into the area now called the South China Sea. And down there, the other thing I talk about in my Atlantis to Tesla book is that one day I was surfing. This is back in the 90s. I'm surfing the old internet, you know, the primitive internet, and people were not that savvy back at that point about security and things like that, especially secure government websites and military websites. So I'm surfing, and I find this website, and it's about a submarine base that's in northern Australia. And so a technique for getting back into the, if you somehow hook into one of these that got out on the internet loose and it was a long string where you had /something/something/something. And it was a long string of these. So I started backing off, removing the part in the slash and seeing what the parent page was. And then you remove another text in slash, and you get another step closer to the actual parent page. So as I did this, I started backing into this U.S. Navy submarine base that was stationed in northern Australia. They were studying Atlantis in the South China Sea. The submarines would go out and secure artifacts. There's no other way to say it. And this was a thing I knew from more than one point of view. I knew because the Chinese were very angry at the American submarines doing all this activity in the South China Sea. And they couldn't do anything about it because China at the time really didn't have a navy, They didn't have an Air Force. They didn't have, they were like a big million and a half, a billion and a half people with not much military capability. They had a huge land army with lots of rifles, but that did not do them any good out in the South China Sea. So the Americans had pretty much free rein to do things out there, but they were out there excavating and discovering the ruins of Atlantis and out of the submarine base in northern Australia. So I have it from that point of view. I have it from the point of view that I knew that the Chinese government was very angry at the U.S. Navy, but couldn't do anything about it at that same time. And then, and by the way, the original, giving credit where credit is due, the original observation that Atlantis was in the South China Sea goes to a Brazilian physicist. We did a very intelligent study. He took a grid work, and he took all of the known properties of Atlantis that we know about. It was a big plain. That was one thing. It was a very large plain. It was surrounded by this massive bog, and it had the Pillars of Hercules, and on and on and on. It was a five-ringed city. It had the statue of Poseidon in the middle. And he didn't talk about the electric connection and the spacecraft that are going up and down. Now, you can imagine Atlantis and how it looked at night. So say you were in an airplane off in the distance, flying in like a jet airliner into Atlantis in the middle of the night. You would see the five-ring city all lit up, like with electric lighting, etc. And you would see in the center a glow, and then you would see the statue of Poseidon, and you would see the electric current going up into the atmosphere, up into the stratosphere, and all the way up. And you would see electromagnetic propulsion system spacecraft riding up and down that electric column. This is the view that you would have seen coming in from the air of Atlantis or from the ocean. If you were a seafarer, a mariner, you would have come in through these canals, and knowing full well that if you were not welcome, you would just be burned out of the water with the lasers that they had. So they had high technology, but I point out in my, this sounds like fantastic to people that are not familiar with my work on Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn connection, but I point out in that book that the technologies, we often think of technologies today as transistors and computers and things like that, but the technologies we're talking about here, lasers, electromagnetic propulsion systems, and lightweight spacecraft, etc., all would be from very lightweight materials, either aluminum, or they could also be made from carbon fiber, something that once you discover, you're just off and running with carbon fiber, and then glass. And so this is, if you had glass works, then you would have lasers, you would have the part one, the part, the very essential part of the electromagnetic propulsion system, etc. And so hardened glass, and the reason hardened glass is because it's transparent to magnetic fields, but it contains the current. It's like a current. It's like a current path. Okay, so at any rate, I could go on and on about this, but I think the visual that I want to leave you with is this idea that say you're coming in an aircraft into Atlantis and you don't have a landing strip like you have with a modern landing field for aircraft, because these are vertical takeoff propulsion systems, and you come in on the electric current, and you would be monitored in with a certain time frame to come down, land, and then get your spacecraft out of there so the next one could either take off or land. So it's a whole different concept of an airport than what we're used to. So it would be like a ring in the electric current that's coming down to Poseidon, which is actually a Tesla coil in the middle of the top ring part of the city of Atlantis, is connected to the upper atmosphere, and there's a significant current coming down, which is powering the whole continent. Now, this is a big area. Look at the South China Sea. Look at the South China Sea, and you'll see it's a very large area. And that all sank overnight, one night, and the people who saw it were there. There were mariners who were there when this happened, and whoosh, you know, it set out a big tsunami, and there would have been a lot of mariners in the ocean at that time who witnessed this and reported on it, and they did. Okay, so at any rate, I'm heading into about 2 minutes left to the show here, or 2.5 minutes, so I'll pick up on this topic, Electric Highways to the Stars, next week. It's such an important topic. And clearly, I'll be putting this into a more organized format. I also talk about this in my paid casts, which are part of my education program. But let me just jump on the topic of water filtration. I spend personally a lot of my time recently discussing and working on water filtration. I have little company that I've had for years, JMCC Water Filters, is growing. The demand for water filtration is growing. And I have the MR5s, which are something that are products that you could use. I also have a commercial line, which is not on the webpage, of larger units. And so if you are connected with an organization or a government agency or a business or a municipality that needs clean water, give me a call or point people my way. There's a information, there's a contact subpage on the webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com. And but for the rest of you out there, the MR5 filter is a whole house filter. It filters out the toxins and everything. It has a ultraviolet final filter. And this really cleans up your water. It's a long list of chemicals and toxins and heavy metals, pharmaceuticals, arsenic. It's all in one filter, which is typical of my historical filters. And also PFAS chemicals. Oh, my goodness. These you got to get out of your water. So the MR5 whole house water filter is on my webpage. Once again, and if you get there, I think that coupon code JMCC still works. So if you're thinking about this, go there. Free shipping, by the way. Free shipping to the 48 states. Alaska and Hawaii, we have to charge you a little bit of shipping because it costs so much. But the 48 states, free shipping. Not a bad deal. Comes to your door. It's a few hours for a plumber to put it in. And you have, it's a 50,000-gallon change-out period for the filters, which is very easy to do. Anybody can do it. So at any rate, it's something that I believe in. It's the best water filter system. And beware of people out there trying to sell a water softener and calling it a whole-house water filter. They're not. They're a water softener. Totally different animal. You need a whole-house water filter. And that's what I have. The best one on the market, and really it's the only one on the market that's really properly designed for your house. And then it pre-filters the water before it goes to the hot, so all the water in your house is filtered. And I'm out of time. James McCanny, this is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.